Welcome to a special conversation about the F-35 program on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today's show will include a conversation with Tom Burbidge, Executive VP and GM of F-35 Program Integration, Ed O'Donnell, Pratt & Whitney F-35 and F-119 Business Development, and John Rambo, Lockheed Martin Program Development VP. Moderating today's show is Federal Drive host Tom Temin.
Well, great to have you all here, and I'm going to direct my first question to Tom Burbidge, and that is, why don't you give us a rundown, basically, on the purpose of the F-35? Why do we have this plane, and what is the United States going to do with it?
Okay, well, thanks for that. The program was conceived back in the early, actually probably the late 80s and early 90s, when the U.S. was on an independent path to build an airplane for each of the U.S. services with a unique set of requirements and a unique design. And then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney decided that that was not a path that was affordable, and that we could, in fact, maybe for the first time in our history, combine all three of those requirements into a single platform. And if we could do that, then we could perhaps capture economies of scale. We could work with our allies, because the model that we use now in operations is a joint service, coalition-based, long-term peacekeeping and combat operations. But our equipment that we do that with today was not set up in the beginning to operate that way. So maybe we could enter that next dimension, you know, with a common platform, basically exactly the same airplane from the pilot's perspective, but uniquely designed for the operating service that it's representing, and then allow the allies to participate. If we did that right, then we could also build coalition ties militarily, we could build coalition ties industrially and economically, and it would make us a stronger force to deal with from both a deterrence and a combat capability going forward. That was the genesis of the program.
And so when you have a single platform that is adaptable that way, I guess that means you have a single engine. And what are some of the implications for the power for this? I'll ask that of Ed O'Connell from Pratt & Whitney. What did that mean to Pratt & Whitney, that concept?
Yeah. Well, very similar to what Tom mentioned, is you look at the engine and you look at now combining what we've got today, about 70 legacy aircraft that are flying around the world. And when I say legacy aircraft, I mean the current force structure that both the United States is flying, as well as our partners around the world. That means you have 7 different engines as well. And as you look at the cost associated with supporting 7 different engine programs throughout the world, and different countries standing up different capabilities, the U.S. standing up different capabilities, the going forward cost associated with that is astronomical. Plus the fact that we can leverage each other. When we look at the maintenance and the sustainment going forward, we're able to use our partners' assets and they can use our assets. We can trade back and forth when we go to do peacekeeping operation and other operations that are required for our national security. We can help and leverage each other, and thus overall reduce our costs and increase the readiness that we have on the propulsion system and thus the airplane.
Now, John Rambo, you're the guy that's got to make sure it's fulfills the needs of our allies, the people we're going to sell this plane to. And so what purpose have they got for it? Because they have some of the old stuff still flying that the United States built in years past.
Right. Well, you know, Tom, I think, told a very good story for why the U.S. wanted to go with a joint model for designing a single platform that could serve multiple missions. And I think when you extend that discussion to our coalition partners, you know, they can leverage the U.S. infrastructure. They can share in the design costs for a single program versus having their own aircraft designed within their country. And it also affords them, you know, a much greater degree of flexibility from a financial standpoint. They're much more constrained fiscally even than the U.S., especially in this economic environment. So the costs for them to develop and field the aircraft are substantially less. And the cost of sustaining the aircraft will be substantially lower, because they'll be able to leverage a shared infrastructure that the U.S. will deploy around the globe.
Now, other nations, of course, can build planes and do. So it sounds like internationally, this almost is preemptive for the United States to maintain a lot of industrial superiority in having this plane before somebody else comes in for those partners.
Well, the aircraft certainly is a leap ahead in technology, and the U.S. And U.S.-based firms are developing the lion's share of the capability in terms of new technologies, but certainly there is an industrial component to the relationship with each country. You know, there's some economic benefit for them in terms of being able to provide second sources for certain components and sharing in the new technology, so it certainly does provide benefits in that area as well.
Can I tag on to that, Tom? I just want a quick comment. the allies that are part of this project, with the exception of the United Kingdom, all fly frontline U.S. fighters today. So even though they're European countries, in some cases South Pacific countries like Australia, they do fly today's frontline U.S. airplanes. So they bought those airplanes roughly the same time frame that the U.S. bought the airplanes that they're replacing with this airplane. So we're not necessarily replacing European airplanes as much as we are continuing on that partnership that's been there for quite some time.
Now, with respect to air superiority, which this plane you're saying will give the United States, does it also give the other countries the same superiority? That is to say, do they get the exact same plane that the U.S. military gets?
Yes, I think the best way to think about this is not from an air superiority standpoint, but from the multi-role missions that the airplane performs. We actually have 22, I think it is, different missions that the airplane is designed to perform. And many of them are to hold strategic targets at risk. Sometimes we get into this dialogue about nobody else has an airplane that's quite as good as ours in the sky today. That's certainly true. But this airplane's principal mission is to hold a strategic target on the ground at risk. And I think everybody would agree that understands the challenge that there's been a proliferation of integrated defense systems that surround geographical, strategically important targets. Penetrating that defense system and being effective in the future going forward is a real change in requirements versus what today's airplanes are capable of doing. So that's the real driver. If we encounter an air threat while we're doing that, we're fully capable of handling the air threat too.
But it's not primarily about dogfights and plane to plane, but keeping things pinned down that might be well emplaced on the ground.
I think that's it from part of it from a military perspective. Even more important, I think it's been in all of our answers so far, is the potential to do that with a common infrastructure. What really is the cost driver on this program is the cost of owning and operating the airplane over long periods of time and bringing lots of air forces together to do those operations. You now have the ability to do that phase of the life of the airplane with a much smaller infrastructure and a much, much smaller total cost.
And the stealth aspect plays a big part of this too, I imagine.
Stealth does play a big part. It's one of the factors of what we call a fifth-gen airplane. It's an important one because it brings the pilot in the airplane the element of surprise. We couple that with very high-performance sensor systems that give the pilot the near-perfect situational awareness of what's going on around him. So if you put those two things together, I can deny you knowledge of who I am and where I am, but I have near-perfect knowledge of who you are and where you are. I now have a very substantial tactical advantage. Probably the third piece of that is now, if you think about the internet and the movement of information, this system is also designed to gather and distribute information across a wide variety of platforms. That's something that today's generation of airplanes just weren't designed to do.
So if I could just add on a little bit as well. I mean, Tom, you often talk about the benefit, and I think we've touched on a little bit as you were talking about it here, the benefit of having a common platform in these different countries. So right now, we operate so many different platforms. The handoffs in communication as we go off and do things in Libya and Afghanistan and in Iran sometimes are not as smooth and seamless as we might think. And there's a lot of background information that's got to go on, a lot of background preparation that has to go on because each country is operating a different airplane. With the JSF, if you think about now having a common system in a common communication channel and the airplanes communicating with each other without pilot interaction necessarily, and you think about the benefits that you can then gain for that, you can further reduce cost and increase your lethality as you go forward.
And John, do the other countries, the other partners in this whole enterprise, do they get the networked nature of the plane, the information sharing aspect? Because that's, I guess, as important as the stealth piece, really, nowadays.
They absolutely do. And that's one of the critical elements of being able to operate as a coalition. So as you see operations take place, like what we've seen recently in Libya with coalition partners collaborating on a single focused mission, having that interoperability and that ability to communicate more effectively across the different nations is going to be critical.
And Ed, can this all be done with one engine? I mean, some planes have two. Do you ever worry about just having one, all your eggs in one basket?
Well, if you look at the vast majority, if you go way, way back into history, of course, some of the first fighter aircraft, they all had a single engine, right? And if you look at the technology and the improvements that we've put into engines over the years and how much we run them, how much experience we get on them, the demands that we place on them, and you look at single engine safety, the single engine safety records and the projections for single engine safety for the JSF are far superior to twin engine airplanes that we've seen in the past. So yes, the answer is absolutely yes. Having a single engine fighter is a very reliable and safe proposition as we go forward.
All right, we've been talking about the cost aspect with a common platform, many nations, and that gives you high volumes. Let's talk about the cost issues that has been discussed in Congress, and you know, weapons programs are very hard to predict. Give us the current status, if you will, Tom Burbidge, on the cost of the plane. How are things economically or financially at this point, where we stand in the program now?
When you talk about cost on a major complex weapon system like this, you tend to talk about the acquisition, the price, the what does it cost to drive it off the showroom floor kind of a price. In reality, that's only a small part of the overall lifecycle cost of the airplane. We have the development program, which is probably the most comprehensive and complex in the history of development, with a highly common family of three airplanes going through a very long and intensive test program. We have the production facilities that we've now put in place around the world to support high-rate manufacturing and again, capturing those economies of scale. And then you have the all-important cost of ownership and cost of operations throughout the life cycle. I would offer there's even a fourth element, and that's the what we currently do on a regular basis, day in and day out, our long-term peacekeeping or combat operations with all three U.S. services and our allies. The cost of doing that is as much of a budget drain on all the participating nations as any other element of cost in this whole discussion. So I think all four of those you have to look at, and oftentimes the debate quickly narrows down into just one of those. But when you look at all four of those, it takes a program like this to actually capture economies of commonality across the airplanes, economies of scale in terms of pure numbers, and really driving down all elements of that cost equation. The most focused cost is what's the acquisition cost of actually buying the system. It actually is probably one of the more minor elements of the total cost, but it's very important, and the perceptions of it are very important. And we are in the early stages of the program. We're coming down a cost improvement curve rapidly. We've lowered the cost of the airplane about 50% in the first three production lots. We'll continue down that cost improvement curve. We're at the point now where it becomes very sensitive to annual quantities and total quantities. They tend to be very important. We have a large fixed cost infrastructure with factories and particularly modernized investments that we've made in those factories. And the more we can spread those costs over increasing numbers of units, the less the incremental impact of those costs is. So that's really the major contributor going forward, is to make sure that we continue to keep the program on track to build them at the quantities that allow us to be efficient and capture those economies of scale.
And are those kinds of economic issues with respect to quantity and time also applicable to the engine development and manufacturing too?
Absolutely. I want to tag on to something that Tom said, and then I'll come back to the engine real quick. You know, we often look at and the cost issues and the cost questions and affordability questions that come to play for the JSF are often looked at the JSF by itself. There's never really a comparative that is made, and the reality of it is the alternative is to continue to operate what we have today. And I would argue that the development and the production cost and the sustainment cost of the JSF as we go forward is a much more affordable solution set for the United States of America and our allies than to continue to operate the current systems that they have today going forward, because those airplanes are getting very tired and they're becoming more and more expensive to maintain. On an engine perspective, we've got the same activities, almost mirroring exactly what Lockheed Martin has had. We've seen significant cost reduction, comparable levels of cost reduction on the production engines as we've gone from the first lot of production to the current fourth lot of production that we have. Our rate has continued to build. Today we see, as we continue through production, and if we continue to go on an increasing rate by 2017, we'll be producing this engine, the F-135 engine. We'll be producing it at the same cost as we produce the engine that powers the F-22. Now, on the surface, that may not seem that significant, but this engine produces 25% more thrust. It weighs 1,500 pounds more, or 30% more than the F-119 engine that's in the F-22. So when you think about us getting to that same cost level that we produce the F-119 engine today, it's pretty remarkable. Tom's comments about rate, if we were to decide to flatten the rate of production of this airplane, all we do is we push out that affordability benefit into later and later years, and it becomes less and less significant to the U.S., the industrial base, and to our allies.
And, John, would it be possible for the allies, the other customers, to pick up that slack, or does it have to really start with quantities of the United States?
Well, certainly the United States quantities are the largest driver here, but the international partners bring a significant component of the overall aircraft buy. We actually have the first production aircraft for partners coming in the next production buy. So we have Australia and Italy that will be purchasing their first production aircraft coming up in the next year. And we'll see that gradually ramp up from there. So I think in the next 5 years or so, Tom, is it something in the order of 40% of the annual buy we anticipate being international?
And that then allows you to do what's called high leveraging in the U.S. buy. If you were buying 10 airplanes and you're really only buying six, the other guys are buying four, then you have pretty high leverage on driving these costs down. So,
but ultimately, you really have to convince Congress to go along with quantities that get the United States the benefits that you're promising. Otherwise, it doesn't happen.
That's exactly right, and that's we're spending a lot of time right now trying to make sure that everybody who is making important decisions on this program is fully aware of and briefed on the different dynamics that are associated with this program. It's designed to recapitalize a multi-service coalition large force. It's not a single service program. It needs to be procured in larger quantities than the individual programs that have come up in the past.
And that must help the go ahead.
One of the things that we forget about is that the JSF it's in production. We're producing production aircraft. And when you're in production, you have a very different methodology and mentality than when you're in development. We have largely completed development, and we are actively flying this airplane. It's been deployed to Eglin Air Force Base, and we're in production. And the main focus you have in production is building rate and driving affordability. And so all of us are focused on doing that, and we're looking for the opportunity to continue to drive that affordability initiative with appropriate rate.
And how many do we have now in the fleet at this point?
We have four airplanes at Eglin Air Force Base, which will actually be the initial cadre to begin the integrated training center. We don't have any operational jets that are out in the fleet yet. We have 13 airplanes that are actually in flight tests. In fact, we have two airplanes that are out today as we speak on the ship, on the USS Wasp doing sea trials. We'll populate the training center now for the rest of this year and into next year, and then we'll start standing up the first Operational Marine Corps squadron in the very near future. So we're starting that transition now from production into training into operational use.
You're listening to a conversation on the F-35 program here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Our guests are Tom Burbidge, Executive Vice President and General Manager of the F-35 Joint Strike Force Program Integration Office at Lockheed Martin Aeronautics, John Rambo, Vice President for the F-35 International Programs at Lockheed Martin, and Ed O'Donnell, Vice President for Business Development for the F-135 and F-119 engine business at Pratt & Whitney. I'm Tom Temin. We'll be back in just a moment.
To the Marines who watch over the skies, it says the enemy can't see you. To the Marines who carry out their mission on the ground, it says I have your back. To adversaries, it says don't even think about it. It is the F-35B, the fifth generation multi-role fighter jet that combines short takeoff and vertical landing capability with supersonic speed and radar evading stealth. The F-35B, the multi-role fighter that's equipped to go wherever Marines must go. Wherever the mission takes them, our Marines know it will be there. It's the F-35B, a fighter jet that can take off and land virtually anywhere, from the most remote, austere airfields and roads to modern ships. That means it can be based close to frontline combat, shrinking the distance between base and target. For the Marines and for our nation, that's a game-changing advantage. The F-35B, the multi-role fighter that's equipped to go wherever Marines must go.
And welcome back. In this segment, let's talk about some of the economics of this program, especially the economic impact throughout the country. This is not something I imagine that is sourced and built locally in one factory. Tom Burbidge, tell us a little bit about the parameters of how widely it takes economically to put together a plane like this.
That's a very good question. The industry has evolved substantially in the last decade or so to a prime contractor, major assembly type of capability that we primarily do as the prime, and then a very extensive supply chain. And probably 65 to 70% of our cost is actually resident in companies that are not part of the prime contractor. So we have a very, very broad scale supply chain. One of the benefits of being an international partner on F-35 and the government-to-government agreements that formed the partnership was an an invitation to participate on a best value basis for the defense-related companies that are in that country. And if you think about it, during the period of time when some of the smaller nations are actually buying the airplane, most of their discretionary budget will go to this project and by definition won't be going to their own domestic industry. So their ability to participate, compete, and win work on F-35 is critical to just sustain their industrial base. So we have all dimensions of that. There's been a number of transformations that have occurred inside the industrial base, primarily in the area of advanced manufacturing techniques for composites and metal machining. And then we bring all those components together into major subassemblies, and we bring the major subassemblies into our final assembly facility in Fort Worth. But we manage a very extensive global supply chain, pretty typical of our business these days. If you talk to the large commercial suppliers, Boeing, Airbus, that we're all in a commercial supply chain now, global supply chain. So it's very complex. We, as part of this transformation, we talk about transforming the military capability of the multi-role infrastructure. We're also very much transforming the aerospace industry that supports the F-35. We're going to much tighter manufacturing tolerances, much higher levels of precision, motion-based systems. All that is to enable us to build the airplane at efficient, high production rates.
Yeah, this is not a lot of rivets and bumps, and I mean, it's a pretty smooth
You would actually
character.
You'd be very surprised if you walked into the factory today at how quiet it is. We don't assemble airplanes like we did the last one. Even the F-22, our most recent one, you could hear the assembly process when you walked in the factory. This factory is very quiet. So we do it completely different than we've done in the past. We align, you know, major subassemblies in space with lasers very accurately. They're not held in hard tools like they have been in the past. It's just a whole different philosophy on how you manufacture these very complex machines.
And has that sparked new startups and new companies that participate in this, I guess you'd call it, fifth generation of manufacturing versus some of the people that might have participated in earlier programs?
It has, and it's been also, I think, in my opinion, accelerated by the fact that the prime contractors have gotten out of a lot of the vertical integration activity of fabrication and subassembly. And so as we've pushed that work out, it's allowed a lot more of the small and medium enterprises to now take that work and become vibrant members of the economy. So if you look at the industrial footprint or in the dialogue that you hear in Washington today, the jobs footprint associated with F-35, it is the high-end technical, high craftsman capability jobs that support this program, and it's supported on a very broad industrial base because we don't centralize it in any one company anymore.
And what about the engine? That looks like a pretty complicated subpart in itself. Lots of tubes and parts and things that spin. Tell us about
a lot of metal.
A lot of metal, right?
Yeah.
Tell us how that gets built from a technical and an economic standpoint.
Very similar story as what Tom said on the airplane. A little bit different in the propulsion industry, of course, because we tend to run military and commercial products in the same factories. And plus, we have a much smaller supply chain than you would tend to see in the air vehicle side of the business, primarily because we're dealing with different metals. We're holding much different tolerances, so we tend to have much harder metals. We tend to have a lot of casting work as we get into a lot of the parts of the engine that are quite hot. And so it requires a different level of technology and expertise when you're working propulsion. And generally speaking, you don't have a propulsion company that's also doing air vehicle work, especially when you get into the main turbo machinery of the engine. We've got about 4,000 folks working on the F-135 engine throughout 26 states in the United States. And what's interesting is about half of them are small to medium enterprises. So there's a lot of folks that are depending upon this airplane and the rate that's continuing to build. We go through a whole array of activity. Most people, they look at a company like Pratt & Whitney and would say, well, you know, Pratt's building the whole engine. But most people are quite surprised when they come to appreciate that 75 to 80% of what we do is outsourced into the supply base. And we have to depend, and we depend heavily upon our supply base as we go forward. All the way from the development of the part for controls and accessories and prognostics and fifth gen LO activities up through sub-assembly work and delivering to our assembly floor. On the engine side, on the JSF, we're working with three major companies, Pratt & Whitney. Rolls-Royce is working and doing the lift components for us for the short takeoff and vertical landing version of the airplane. And then Hamilton Sunstrand, who's another part of United Technologies, does the entire control suite associated with the engine.
I just have to ask this one question. Do they still fire chickens at a running engine to see if it holds up anymore?
They do. I don't know if they're always chickens, but we do a lot of bird strike and ingestion testing and ice ingestion testing, and we do sand ingestion testing and things like that as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, John Rambo, now this is an international piece, and so the partners around the world, let's talk about who some of them are and how they participate, not just in the buying of the plane, but in the economic activity toward building it.
Sure. Well, you know, there's a distinction that we can make. There are eight partners, countries that actually participated in funding the development of the aircraft, participated in setting some of the standards in terms of the operational requirements for the airplane. And then we have another category of countries that will be buying the airplane but had not participated in the development, which we call our foreign military sales partners. So the eight countries who actually participated as partner nations in the development program were Australia, UK, Canada, Turkey, Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, and Italy, I believe. Got all of them there. And the first FMS country to come on board so far has been Israel. And we have several others that we're hopeful in the next, say, 12 months to bring on as well.
So that's one that's buying but did not participate in the development.
Israel is buying but did not participate in the development. That's correct.
Okay, so eight countries. And you said there's, Ed, that there's about 38 states involved in the engine?
Well, for the engine, we've got 26 states.
26 states.
Right.
And how many states for the airplane itself?
We have work in about 47 states, I think, if you went and actually looked at the distribution of all the small and medium enterprises that support the program. So it's quite widespread, and a lot of that is because we now push that work out, and it is competed. There are many more companies that compete and don't win work on the program, but they have to compete and provide best value. I'd like to tag on one thing that John said, and that's that the program was conceived in the beginning to form this international partnership, and in the government-to-government agreements that were struck back in the 2001-2002 timeframe, industrial participation was a key element of that discussion. In order to get the international partners to actually invest in the program, there's a requirement in their countries to have strong political support to do that, and that gets tied into the industrial and economic returns. We've maintained that partnership in about the same ratio of number of airplanes the partners are buying to number of airplanes the U.S. is buying over time. And as you can probably surmise, some of the countries have a much more mature and advanced aerospace industry than some of the smaller countries. And in those countries, we're able to actually have some of the major subassembly work done also. So it's been a very interesting evolution. Many of those smaller companies didn't have any experience doing business with the United States or with a large U.S. prime. We had a number of outreach programs that include the State Department and Department of Defense and the industry like Lockheed Martin going out and trying to teach these international countries how to actually participate and be competitive.
We talked about international as well. One just other aspect of that is that we've already delivered the first international engine, actually. So again, it gets back to this whole discussion that this program is really in production. It's a multinational program, and it's not just the United States that is now moving into the production phase.
To sort of reinforce what Ed's saying on the level of integration, the UK, United Kingdom, and the Netherlands are both been allowed to participate in operational tests of the airplane. So they're each buying several airplanes, and their pilots will come and join with the U.S. test force and test those airplanes. If you come into Fort Worth today, the first UK airplane is sitting on our flight line. You can walk out and touch all five of those airplanes today. So the first initial international buys are test airplanes. The first operational buys are the ones that will come in starting this year.
Right. And let's talk about the plane itself. What is it that you're testing? You know it can fly and land safely, but what is it you look for? The electronics or the handling? Or what are some of the things that need to be tested at this point?
That's a good question. The testing divides into a number of different categories. There is ground testing for airplanes that are never intended to fly. We put the airplanes into large fixtures and we try to stress them to the engineering limits of the design to make sure that they can withstand all the loads they'll see in flight. Most of that testing is complete. There's also, if you divide up the flight testing, it divides into two categories. There's flight sciences, which is the flight envelope demonstrating that the airplane meets the requirements that it was scheduled to meet. And then there's mission systems testing, which tests all the sensors and all the performance of the intelligence gathering capability of the airplane. Both of those are proceeding very well right now. We're running actually a little ahead of schedule. We're doing some of the tough flight sciences stuff now with the two airplanes that are at the ship. Our Navy airplane has been up at Lakehurst, New Jersey, and we've done 60 catapult shots with it now. The Air Force airplane's out at Edwards testing in it in the Air Force environment. So all of them have to test unique capabilities in the environment of the service that's acquiring that variant, but all of them test in a common way as to what the sensors do. It's interesting, if you put a pilot in the airplane, if you were the pilot sitting in the airplane, you wouldn't necessarily know which airplane you're in. They're exactly the same in the cockpit. Sensors are exactly the same. Stick and throttle are the same. We have pilots now capable of jumping from one airplane to the other without any special training. It's quite amazing what this family of airplanes can do for you in terms of simplifying all that.
And this plane is flown with one crew member or two?
One pilot. It's a single piloted airplane. And the computer is helping take care of a lot of the housekeeping chores. What had been housekeeping or airplane management chores in the past, and the pilot's relieved of those, and now he can really concentrate on being the tactician and the mission manager.
And Ed, when you get in and start one up, it used to be there were like 17 steps to start, the 1940s to get an engine started. Is that all managed automatically? What kind of software is involved to make that all operate so the pilot can concentrate on the situation and not the propulsion?
Yeah. Well, in the propulsion world, what you'd love to hear is nothing about the engine, right? And that it's never commented on, because that means everything's working fine. And Tom is fond of saying how integrated this airplane is and the propulsion system. And when you look at this airplane and engine compared to an F-16, it really is one. Now it's all one. The engine fits like a, you know, tightly into the airplane. It's all highly integrated. It's hard to tell what is engine-controlled software versus aircraft-controlled software because it is highly integrated. I kind of like to look at it as it's sort of like the Intel inside. You know, the engine is like the Intel inside, I guess. And we've also done different things now when you look at STOVL. On an airplane that is completely hovering, there's been a complete handoff, basically, from the air vehicle to the propulsion system, because it's now all propulsion system that's keeping that airplane in the air.
I've seen the videos. It's hard to believe, actually. Yeah.
And so when you start to think about what Tom said, that the pilot doesn't have to really think about that, and then you start to think about how could that possibly be, and the trades and the handoffs that are occurring between the two systems, I think it's a great tribute when you think through how that's occurred. It's a great tribute to the Joint Program Office in the United States, the allied countries that have helped develop this, but certainly Lockheed Martin and Pratt & Whitney working together to make that happen.
And John, which unit is, or which style, I guess we should say, is going overseas first? Because not that many nations have carriers the way the United States does.
Right. Well, the first that will go overseas will be the conventional variant for the Air Force variant that we have here in the U.S. So we'll start to see those go overseas for both Italy and for the Australians. We do have the U.K. will also buy the carrier variant of the aircraft. And we have plans for the Italians to buy the STOVL, short takeoff vertical landing variant, as well. So we have all three variants going overseas, but predominantly the Air Force variant will be the one they purchase the most often.
And there's a difference between the naval carrier straight takeoff version and the Air Force version?
Correct. The carrier variant has a slightly larger wing, and it has a wing that folds up for storage on a carrier, and that one does require a catapult to take off from the deck. The short takeoff vertical landing can take off without a catapult.
Okay, in the United States, who's buying which? Well, the Air Force is buying the Air Force version, the Navy version. How about that STOVL version? Who's getting that one?
That is for the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps today operates Harriers, short takeoff vertical
jump jet. Airplanes. They call that,
yes, off of their L-class ships and in expeditionary operations when they're ashore on lesser prepared fields, and the F-35B will step into that role.
You're listening to a conversation on the F-35 program here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Our guests are Tom Burbridge, Executive Vice President and General Manager of the F-35 Joint Strike Force Program Integration Office at Lockheed Martin Aeronautics, John Rambo, Vice President for the F-35 International Programs at Lockheed Martin, and Ed O'Donnell, Vice President for Business Development for the F-135 and F-119 engine business at Pratt & Whitney. I'm Tom Temin. We'll be back in just a moment.
To the Marines who watch over the skies, it says the enemy can't see you. To the Marines who carry out their mission on the ground, it says I have your back. To adversaries, it says don't even think about it. It is the F-35B, the fifth generation multi-role fighter jet that combines short takeoff and vertical landing capability with supersonic speed and radar evading stealth. the F-35B, the multi-role fighter that's equipped to go wherever Marines must go. Wherever the mission takes them, our Marines know it will be there. It's the F-35B, a fighter jet that can take off and land virtually anywhere, from the most remote, austere airfields and roads to modern ships. That means it can be based close to frontline combat, shrinking the distance between base and target. For the Marines and for our nation, that's a game-changing advantage. The F-35B, the multi-role fighter that's equipped to go wherever Marines must go.
And welcome back to the show. In this third segment, let's talk about some of the futures. And the future begins with now, of course. And the F-35 has been described as a fifth-generation aircraft. What does that mean, and how does that make it differ from fourth-generation aircraft?
That's a good question, Tom. The fifth-generation moniker has sort of evolved over time to show that there is a step function difference in capability versus the airplanes that are operating today. And really, nations or groups of nations are faced with a major decision to continue to upgrade current capabilities or to make the big investment and go to the next generation. And back in 2000-2001 timeframe, when this contract was awarded, the U.S. made the decision to take that step and invite our allies to participate. So we went to the next level of generation. And you say, why do you do that? These programs are very long. You know, we're 10 years into this program now. We'll be 15 years into it before we field the first operational jets. I've often heard it said that most of the pilots that fly the F-35 have not been born yet. And we do project this airplane to fly into a different environment than we currently fly in today in Iraq or Afghanistan. And you have to keep your perspective on where the world is going, not just where the world is today when you make these major investments. So fifth generation combines, in our parlance, combines a number of new technologies. The number one is stealth, and it's not that there's not stealthy airplanes. We've got three of them out there today, the F-117, the B-2, and the F-22. The F-117 has recently been retired. But it's not been out there on a large scale in terms of transforming the multi-role fighter force. That's what F-35 brings. You add to that the integrated avionics, what they call multispectral sensors, day, night, all weather, basically the ability to surveil, gather information, understand what's happening, and then share that information, not just with other airplanes in the flight, but with command and control centers and other assets. So that's number two. Number three is advanced sustainment. We've gone through this design on this airplane, nose to tail, to look at what would you do to drive down the cost of maintaining the airplane once it gets fielded. The benefits of all that haven't been fully tested and proven yet, so you don't get a lot of credit for that until such time as it is proven. But clearly, we've designed the airplane to radically drive down the cost of owning it in the long run. And then the fourth one is what we call the interoperability piece, or the ability to share the information the airplane's gathering and to provide eyes and ears for the command and control platforms in areas where they can't fly today. So all of those capabilities are fairly top level, and then they shred down into a very detailed set of fundamental needs requirements that aren't in the current capabilities of today's airplane. So when we talk about fifth gen, that's what we mean, that the decision was made to go to the next level of capability. That capability is going to be around for a long, long time. Today, we're projecting the production line to run out into the late 2030s and the operational fleet to run out probably 40 to 50 years. So we're building for the future.
And looking overseas, John, do the military planners there kind of see the same world that the U.S. military planners see? And if so, what characterizes that military environment?
They do. They see a similar world. And I think Tom mentioned earlier that a lot of the countries we're working with today are flying today U.S.-developed platforms. So the useful life of the aircraft that they have fielded today is similar to what the U.S. is facing. And they're looking at, in some cases, environments that are even more demanding than what the U.S. faces in many of our locations. So they're flying their aircraft quite a bit. A lot of them are wearing out, and they need something to replace it. And this fifth-generation capability is going to be necessary in order to operate in the environment they're going to face going forward.
But it sounds like the stealth is a much more important component going forward than it has been until now.
It absolutely will be much more important for them. The threat environment is becoming a lot more sophisticated, and some of the partners that we're going to be working with are going to have real threats that they're going to be facing in the near future.
Now, stealth, of course, reflects radar, so the plane looks invisible or largely so to radar, but there's also a hot engine in there. And what role does that play? How do you mitigate the effects of heat sensing technology as the plane is stealthy to radar at the same time.
Well, you're exactly right, Tom. Heat is one of the major exports of the engine, obviously, as you go forward. And Lockheed and Pratt & Whitney have been working very closely on fifth-generation fighters over the past several years. And both the F-119 engine that's in the F-22 as well as the F-135 engine are the only two afterburning fighter engines in the world today that employ stealth technology in all aspects and working with the fifth generation F-35. Tom talked about the integration. And so whenever we talk about stealth, we look at the entire system. It's not an engine by itself. And we have a lot of requirements that we work together on to ensure that while we are operating the engine, that it is as transparent as possible, even from a propulsion perspective as well. Some other aspects on the engine that we'd look forward to that are specific to fifth gen fighters are the prognostics suites. In the old days, we used to do stuff off the engine. We used to calculate different things, life. We used to troubleshoot engines when they had problems. A lot of times you didn't see it unless there was an issue. And what we're now evolving to is having the engine basically, and I would say the airplane as well, have a doctor on board, if you will, is always analyzing, is always interrogating, is always assessing the capability of the program, looking forward, if you will, into the future, such that if an issue is to come up, it will know it before it happens, and thus allow the maintainers and others to take care of that engine or that airplane before it has to go on its next mission. I think that's a huge aspect of fifth generation capability that is not employed today in our current legacy airplanes.
Now, can the engine be changed out? That is to say, if we're going to build 2,500 of these over these next couple decades, does one engine go with one plane for its entire life cycle, or does that have to be changed?
What is one of the great things about this program, and again, it gets back to the affordability initiatives that we've got in this program, you could take an engine that's sitting in a CTOL, an Air Force version airplane. It could come out of that airplane. It could go into a carrier variant airplane for the Navy. You could take it out of that airplane. You could add a lift fan to it, to the airplane, and a different nozzle, the one that kind of curves down for the STOVL, and still use the heart of that engine in a STOVL application. So instead of having three different engines and three different variants of engines to support the fleet, you really have one core principal engine that can carry all that horsepower and that weight.
So, Tom, excuse me, I think Ed's hitting on a point that's important for the listeners, and that's that one of the real values of this family of airplanes is the ability to drive down expensive infrastructure that maintains a very broad multivariant fleet today. I think I've heard the U.S. Marine Corps say that they're going from three different airplanes down to a single type model series with the F-35B, and that'll save them up to about $1 billion a year just in additional infrastructure that's required to maintain the three different types of airplanes. So you multiply that across three services in a number of nations, and there's a huge cost that we can't really quantify until such time as the infrastructure shrinks to accommodate it, you know.
I think it's important to reiterate the fact that this is not a plane necessarily for air-to-air combat as we've thought of fighters in the past, but really is aimed at military threats that have evolved pretty suddenly in the last 10 years and that you think will get worse as time goes on. You might want to discuss that a little bit.
I would say that if you go back to the founding pillars that are referred to or the fundamental principles of the program, there's four of them. The first one is that the system needs to be lethal. If you do call on, you know, our successors, our children, our grandchildren, to actually have to go employ this in combat, you want it to be lethal and get the job done. The second one is you want it to be survivable. You want it to come home at the end of the fight. And probably from the military technology side, those are the two areas that are most advanced with this technology that we're talking about. The third thing is you want it to be supportable over the life cycle of the program to drive down that cost of ownership we're talking about. And the fourth one they label as affordability. I want to attack all the things that drive the cost of maintaining a military air power capability, whether it's single service, joint service, or coalition. If I'm working to drive all four of those elements to their optimum solution, I now have a full fifth generation airplane, and they're all four fundamental to F-35.
Now, in some of the older planes, you replace internal parts and spars and so forth from time to time. This is made in very different techniques, with composites and so forth. Is it also, from a structure shell standpoint, sustainable way into the future as the stresses mount?
Well, we believe that there have been some very substantial breakthroughs in terms of the long-term supportability of the airplane, and a lot of it's driven by the broader use of advanced composites. You know, composites are something that you can build. You don't machine them on a machine. You build them up from the basics, and you can actually put some capability. You can carry aerodynamic load in composites now. That allows you to open up your frame spacing, put larger integrated systems in the airplane. You can take away some of the exotic treatments that go on a stealthy airplane and actually embed them in the composite. There's lots of things that it now opens the door to drive down the cost of both building the airplane and maintaining the airplane over its life.
And we've talked about the economics, and one question I had, just to return to that, is, are there technology lessons that you're learning through building the propulsion system and the airplane itself that might transfer to the commercial world over time and benefit the economy in that way?
I think there are. I'll go first and let Ed chip in. There's a number of things we're doing from a manufacturing perspective. If you just look at manufacturing processes, you know, in terms of automation and precision, and a very complex part of building an airplane is the actual drilling of holes and putting different thicknesses or different lengths of fasteners in the airplane. It's very cumbersome and time-consuming the way we've done it in the past. This airplane, that's all kept in a digital database, and we project it with lasers onto the surface of the wing, and now a worker doesn't have to go leaf through volumes of data. It's actually right there projected on the hole. So again, everything we're doing is to shorten cycle time. That's a critical element of any commercial operation too. So I think you're seeing already, and you'll see more transfer of some of the new technology, new process applications we're looking at now transfer over to commercial use.
Sounds like a good way to build cars sometime.
We actually stole a lot of our moving motion-based systems from Toyota. I wouldn't say steal them. We actually asked Toyota to come help us figure out how to apply some of the moving production line technology to an airplane. It's a lot different than building a car because you've got a lot more stuff that goes in an airplane. But we had a number of what we call Kaizen events with the senior senseis from Japan, and we actually looked at how would you lay out a production line to actually build a next-generation fighter on it, and it's fundamental to the way we build the airplane.
Because we should note that the factory in Fort Worth built B-24s back in World War II, so
correct.
The building's probably very different inside than it was then.
It's quite different. It's a whole different place if you come down to see it now.
And the engine, is that going to end up in an airliner sometime, or what are we learning from this program that might transfer commercially?
Well, it certainly there's a lot of transfer in between both the military and the commercial side. It's important to note that back in 2000, we moved our military business from Florida to Connecticut, and that's where our commercial business was located. And what that allowed us to do is leverage the engineering staffs across programs. And so as you have an upturn in military and perhaps a downturn in commercial, you've got the ability to move that workforce back and forth. We moved a lot of folks from our commercial engineering staff over to the JSF program, and we moved a lot of people from the JSF program as we've gone into production. A lot of the engineers have gone into our new single-aisle engine application, the geared turbofan, which is on the Airbus 320neo and is on Bombardier's airplane and Mitsubishi's regional jet. We employ a lot of the same technology. We have a standard operating system at Pratt & Whitney and actually throughout United Technologies called Achieving Competitive Excellence. ACE is the acronym for that. And what that does is employs a lot of standard work, standard design principles, and a lot of that activity is generated, a majority of that activity is generated from the military programs like the JSF that benefit the commercial airline industry and our commercial product lines.
And just briefly, tell us what it's like when you deliver one, even if it's only for testing but not for operation. That must be a pretty proud moment for an Air Force or a Navy to get their first F-35.
I think it's one of the really neat parts about being in this business and being on this project is we all feel like we're doing something for the future of the services that most of us served in a previous life. And when you see a first flight, no matter whether it's the very first one or the 10th first flight, you still get that sort of shiver and chill and you're watching history being made.
And if people want,
because we live in a pretty small community with the aerospace community, and I know every day that people come to, and you were just touching on a point and the goosebumps you get every day that people come to work at Pratt & Whitney on the military engine side, the thing that's foremost in their mind is the men and women in uniform. And what can we do today to support the men and women in uniform, not only for the things that they're flying today, but also for things that we're doing on the JSF? And that cuts across the entire enterprise of all the companies that are really working on this airplane.
And on that note, we will close this discussion. Our guests today have been Tom Burbidge, Executive Vice President and General Manager for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter Program Integration at Lockheed Martin Aeronautics, John Rambo, Vice President of the F-35 International Programs at Lockheed Martin Aeronautics, and Ed O'Donnell, Vice President for Business Development for the F-135 and F-119 engine business at Pratt & Whitney. This has been a special conversation on the F-35 program here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for joining us for this conversation on the F-35 program. Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com comprise the key source of breaking news, information, and analysis for individuals responsible for carrying out and supporting the missions of federal agencies. Federal News Radio addresses federal agency managers, policymakers, and contractors. Federal News Radio's coverage is nonpartisan, non-political, and is designed to help executives more clearly understand and make better decisions about issues affecting their agencies and their companies. If you missed any portion of the show, you can listen to the show in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsradio.com.
To the Marines who watch over the skies, it says the enemy can't see you. To the Marines who carry out their mission on the ground, it says I have your back. To adversaries, it says don't even think about it. It is the F-35B, the fifth generation multi-role fighter jet that combines short takeoff and vertical landing capability with supersonic speed and radar-evading stealth. The F-35B, the multi-role fighter that's equipped to go wherever Marines must go. Wherever the mission takes them, our Marines know it will be there. It's the F-35B, a fighter jet that can take off and land virtually anywhere, from the most remote, austere airfields and roads to modern ships. That means it can be based close to frontline combat, shrinking the distance between base and target. For the Marines and for our nation, that's a game-changing advantage. The F-35B, the multi-role fighter that's equipped to go wherever Marines must go.